This is the Legal Disclaimer, where I tell you that the views, thoughts, and opinions shared on this podcast belong solely to our guests and hosts, and not necessarily Brady or Brady's affiliates. Please note, this podcast contains discussions of violence that some people may find disturbing. It's okay. We find it disturbing, too. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Red, Blue, and Brady. I'm one of your hosts, JJ.
And I'm your other host, Kelly.
And our topic for today has been buried in other awful news, like that of mass shootings and COVID and war. But it is something that we find deeply concerning and worthy of attention. And that's the rise of folks calling on a stand your ground defense.
Yeah, not to get all lawyerly, but at least 34 states have stand your ground laws or have expanded Castle Doctrine to apply beyond the home. And it may seem logical to use a firearm to protect yourself, but there is a very real danger in spreading these laws because studies suggest that what they really do is legally empower people to use force even when it's not necessary.
Moreover, there is a real and present danger with how stand your ground defenses play out with law enforcement and the judicial system. And we need to unpack that.
Yeah. And to do just that, we're joined by Cami Chavis, professor of law and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University School of Law.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here and be a part of this wonderful podcast. My name is Cami Chavis. I am a law professor and director of the criminal justice program at Wake Forest University School of Law. I have had many, many hats in my long legal career. After graduating from law school, I worked as an associate in firms in Washington, D.C., and did a number of different things. I mean, everything from international trade to white collar criminal defense and all kinds of things. But I landed in an interesting project related to policing, which we can, you know, also I think is related to this as well. And that really sparked my interest in criminal law. And so after that, I became a prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, D.C. And that really was an eye-opening experience and gave me the opportunity to unfortunately interact with many, you know, with victims of gun violence and defendants who perpetrated that and were prosecuted for it. And so I've just spent a lot of the last few years in my academic career sorting through all those issues and trying to ameliorate gun violence.
And one of the things that, you know, we've talked about on different angles on this podcast is the ways in which gun violence and race cannot be disentangled. And that's something that you've talked about in your work. So, you know, from your perspective and your research, why can't we disentangle race and gun violence?
Well, it's really interesting because when I think about gun violence, I go way back to, you know, over a century ago, when we think about our first domestic terrorists in terms of the Ku Klux Klan and how the members of that group terrorized, black individuals. And a lot of that was through gun violence and other forms of violence for sure. And what we see is that we go kind of through history and fast forward. And then when Black individuals began to arm themselves, we started to see much more strict gun laws. And then, of course, there's just in, within many communities in the United States have experienced gun violence, whether it's, we can point to Chicago as being, a city experiencing acute gun violence. And then when we think about school shootings, so none of us in the country can escape the threat of gun violence in the various contexts in which we are, but we do seem to see some different treatment when it comes to guns and race. And I think one really interesting example of that was the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. So this was, if we think back of over a year ago, really, with protests regarding Jacob Blake's treatment. And again, this is how we, again, connected to police violence. So Blake shot 5 police officers. And then in the ensuing protests, So Jacob Blake was Black. We saw a multicultural crowd protesting the treatment that he received. But it was interesting. We saw lots of white individuals in that Kenosha community patrolling. You know, they took it upon themselves to leave their homes and not to engage, you know, in First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech to protest what was happening to Jacob Blake, but to, in their words, and I'm using air quotes, you can't see me on the podcast, but to protect their communities. And so, and felt the need to do that by being armed and by being armed with guns. And so we see Kyle Rittenhouse, and we know the story there of how he left his home, had this assault rifle, and when there was an altercation, used that and killed, you know, a member of the crowd. And so rather than saying, oh, you know, thinking about, okay, this is an individual who could have stayed at home, who could have come out to watch, who could have come out to, quote, again, air quotes, protect in some way, but chose to do so with a firearm and chose to use that. But he was hailed as a hero, of course, at the time of then, you know, President Trump hailed him as a hero, and he was invited to the White House. Can you imagine? And received so much support from elected members. And, you know, can you imagine that? All we have to do is make that a young African-American or Latino male who did the very same thing. And I do not believe that we would see the same treatment. So, and then of course, we know that he was acquitted for the killing there. But, and again, at the same time, we have, and it's very similar. And actually the trials were happening almost simultaneously with the three individuals who killed Ahmaud Arbery. And Ahmaud Arbery, again, an innocently jogging through a neighborhood and was accosted by a father and son team in a truck. Some of this is on video because, right, the third defendant videotaped this, and he's jogging and the truck is following him, pursuing him. Imagine in his mind what was happening to him. He's being chased by two men again with weapons, with firearms. So, and they used that firearm when he didn't comply with their demands, really their illegal demands. And for what? For the infraction that they alleged was some type of trespassing, right? So that's not even a felony. So we're looking at two situations with white assailants choosing to use firearms. What I think is really interesting here is that at the very beginning of that case, they were not immediately arrested. And it was what we will be talking about today, stand your ground laws that delayed, right, their arrest. And there's a lot that can happen in between an altercation, a homicide like that, and, you know, the person being arrested. So there was a delay there that was absolutely caused in part by the very existence of the stand your ground laws, which was, again, not applicable. And we can get into that.
Yeah, I mean, even thinking when we think about like sort of actions against, you know, sort of groups more broadly, I even think of the NRA coming out against open carry in California when the Black Panthers are beginning to engage in open carry practices as sort of a direct example too of this idea of particular groups saying that it's okay for white folks to be armed.
Exactly. And that's an excellent example. And again, of systemically how that's happened. But a lot of us recall the shooting of Philando Castile, and a lot of folks say, well, we have different. So when we say that race and guns can't be disentangled, again, you have wide swaths of the population in our country that, you know, fight for these very broad rights, but it's really about who has these rights. And they're, I think, very clear through their actions that it's not everyone who would be able to even exercise those rights. And of course, we think about Philando Castile, who illegally was carrying or possessing a firearm and told the officer who stopped him that he had this and he did everything. There was nothing else that Philando Castile could have done. But for that officer, a Black man with a weapon was somehow different because, we have to believe that officer had encountered other people before who were carrying and who he did not shoot. And we also know that officers all across this country face similar situations and yet they don't shoot everyone and kill everyone who they know to be carrying a firearm. So there is something there when we're thinking about race and guns and who should be allowed to have them. And this implicit bias, I really hesitate using the term implicit bias. I think that it absolutely, implicit bias absolutely exists. A lot of most people have, all of us have some type of bias. That's why we talk about implicit bias. But there's enough explicit bias out there for us to talk about. And I don't think we should make ourselves feel better about, oh, well, it was implicit bias. Bias is bias. And we need to try to, and in this case, when we're talking about guns and stand your ground and police officers and the like, that bias can be deadly.
If we could talk specifically about how, what even stand your ground law purports to be.
Yes. So the law professor in me wants a big PowerPoint for everyone with all of the different elements of some of these statutes. But so let's explain stand your ground. So in general, the law of self-defense is an affirmative defense. And that means that the defendant is allowed to argue that whatever use of force they use was justified to protect herself or others from harm. So if we think about with self-defense, if someone, and I'll just use the example of deadly force, since when we're talking about guns, that is deadly force. So someone is approaching you, seriously cause serious bodily injury or some type of deadly harm, you are allowed to defend yourself. That's the law of self-defense. And if you appropriately meet those standards, then even though you may harm or kill that person, you would not be found guilty of it. We say that it was that's a justification defense. So in the case of a use of deadly force, the defendant would need to show that the deadly force was necessary to prevent serious injury of bodily harm or death. And so under the common law, and I'm saying common law as opposed to all of the various state statutes that we have, self-defense imposes a duty to retreat before using deadly force. So that means if I see this person coming at me about to harm me, I have a duty to retreat if I can safely do so. If I can go inside my house or go into a vault and lock myself in, I should do that so that I don't have to use the force. And the underlying rationale for that is that it's the preservation of human life. Where we can avoid a conflict, we should do so. You'd be obligated to do that. And so if you can safely retreat under the common law, if you can safely retreat, then you cannot avail yourself the defense, self-defense. So generally, however, there's no duty to retreat when you're already in your home. And this is the concept called the castle doctrine that we talked about, as if everyone lived in a castle all the time. But anyway, so the castle doctrine says if you're in your home, you don't have to retreat. And that, again, even though we want to preserve human life by having this duty to retreat, there are limits to this. We're not going to ask you to further retreat within your home. That is your safe haven. So when we talk about stand your ground laws, what we're really seeing is an expansion of that castle doctrine and saying there's no duty to retreat. And again, a lot of states, depends on what state you're in, but have expanded that doctrine to include your car, your workplace, And some states have enacted legislation that moves the duty to retreat in all circumstances. So, and this is where we, what we call the stand your ground statute. So in like in all circumstances, you would not have to retreat. And what that really is, and so stand your ground statutes essentially codify the absence of the duty to retreat. And they allow individuals to use deadly force even when there is an option to safely retreat from a potentially dangerous situation. And so if we really look at what that means, that where we were talking about the underlying rationale of having a duty to retreat is the preservation of human life. You've got a lot of state statutes that have said, no, we're not going to do that. And you don't have a duty to retreat. And we're going to codify that.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was how part of what stand your ground does is not only does it remove the duty to retreat, but also in some circumstances, it can cause a delay. And you know, with all the hats you've worn, are probably uniquely qualified to understand and explain how practically removing this duty to retreat, allowing for this affirmative defense or affirmative claim, can actually not only change the outcome of a case, but also change the timing of a case and the trajectory of a case. I'm wondering if you could help us understand how that works.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and it can work differently in different contexts, and it, you know, really does depend on, because again, every state's standard, we can say broadly, you know, standard around, but every state statutes are different and have different nuances. But when I think about, so for example, I mentioned earlier, you know, Ahmaud Arbery, because they in Georgia, you know, does have stand your ground statute. It wasn't applicable here because they were pursuing him, right? He just was jogging and they began to pursue him. But even just being able to say, oh, I was standing my ground. And there were some other problems in the Arbery case with some conflicts of interest and prosecutors needing to eventually recuse themselves. And so I think in many cases, you might've had a sensible prosecutor would have said, no, that's not applicable. I'm going to go ahead and arrest you. And we'll sort this out. But just by having the statute allows you to, like, for example, in Florida, in the case of Trayvon Martin, the police chief said when Zimmerman was, but before Zimmerman was arrested, the chief noted that Zimmerman said, well, I was defending myself. And so he had to wait. He'd have to have probable cause to show that Zimmerman unjustifiably used force. And so again, this, whether it's, you know, and again, these, some decisions can, you can, somebody can look at it immediately, or it could take days.
I think one of the things that's coming out is, one, how horrifying is it that we have so many anecdotal examples of recent cases? And so I'm wondering if we can sort of talk about that disparity of when stand your ground laws, when do they actually get applied to individuals who claim them?
Before we talk about disparities, just thinking about, like, in general, right? So why would you, as a legislature, why would you enact a law that expanded the Castle Doctrine or did away with it altogether? We know that these stand your ground laws, they do not deter crimes, right? And in fact, in some studies have been shown to increase firearm homicide rates. And so I can point to, for example, the Florida stand your ground statute. In 57% of Florida's stand your ground cases, there was clear evidence. And this is, I'm quoting from an Every Town for Gun Safety report. But they said that in clear evidence that the person who claimed that stand your ground could have safely retreated to avoid the confrontation. So this is 57% of those cases where the person, and like we said, we go back to the underlying rationale of even having a duty to retreat. It's so that you can leave, so that we can preserve human life. And in 57% of those cases, that did not happen. So what that is showing us is that these laws allow individuals to forego de-escalation and just use deadly force as a first step. And so, and there's other studies that talk about how some of these laws in some of the areas significantly increase homicide rates. They may have less effects on things like robbery, aggravated assault, burglary rates, things like that, but have increased, you know, we've seen increased homicide rates. So when we get to talking about Black and Brown individuals and minoritized groups, it's, again, there is absolutely evidence that these laws exacerbate racial inequities for both the victims and the defendants. And which I think is again, really interesting, because if you look at some of the states, homicides in which if you have a white shooter that kills a Black victim, a white shooter that kills a Black victim, this is deemed justifiable almost 5 times more than when the situation is reversed. So to your point, JJ, the fact that you have if you're a Black victim, your homicide may be deemed justified. But whereas if a Black shooter and a white victim, if it's reversed, then it wouldn't be. And so that inequity is disturbing. And again, I think that there are, you know, Florida kind of gives us, because that law has been in effect for a while and it's been used quite a bit, is a really a fruitful area for study. But we know that the point is that we know that these laws are not colorblind, and it's all in the application of how you use them. So when both the shooter and the victim have been white, like 11% of cases have been deemed justifiable. But when both parties are Black, there's a lower percentage of Black defendants that are able to successfully use the defense. And so when we have in our law or in our legal system, when we have laws, they should be equally applied, but we're seeing that they're not. And if you're going to have, you know, no matter how, anyone feels about the ability to have this defense, if you're going to have it, then Black folks ought to be able to use it in the same way that white folks, and avoid, you know, criminal time. And I could also say, and Black victims, right, should also be able, the flip side of that is that when this is used, Black victims ought to be able, you know, to have their, to not have their homicides, you know, deemed justifiable when others aren't. So it's clear that there are some racial implications of these laws.
And, you know, as we think about the racial implications, as you said, both for people trying to claim this defense and also people who have been killed by someone claiming the defense, we're also in this weird time where some states are trying to actually add stand your ground laws, or, you know, add something like a stand your ground law to their criminal legal standards. And so I'm wondering, as stand your ground laws are expanding, and there's obviously a risk there for people, where do you see stand your ground going in the future? And do you think that we'll continue to see an expansion of these laws in other states, where there'll be pushback?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. I'm just thinking about back to 2021, where Arkansas and Ohio both passed legislation to expand the Castle Doctrine. And what was really interesting about Arkansas is that the governor, Asa Hutchinson, had not been necessarily supportive of this law. He had said he thought, well, there's no compelling reason to have such a law. But what actually persuaded him the second time around was that the bill was not opposed by law enforcement. And so again, very interesting that you have law. And so I told you we eventually get back to like policing in some sense, but where you have law enforcement that's saying, no, let's let private vigilantes duke it out. That is, in my view, essentially what's happening. And so when law enforcement said, oh, let's let them duke it out, then, you know, the governor says, okay, well, yeah, if they're not going to oppose it, then why would I? So I do think that we are going to see an expansion in these law states that don't have them, or states that have them and are, you know, incrementally try to expand them. The only way that might stop, my position is that I think it needs to stop. I think for the reasons that I've mentioned earlier, when you have these laws, again, it's shoot first, ask questions later. When you have these laws, there's no need to de-escalate and preserve human life. And so, and then again, we have the studies that show that they don't deter crimes, and that they, and some studies that do show that they increase homicide rates. So when I take a look at that whole picture, I think, well, wait a minute, let's stop this. Let's have some study. Let's really dig in deep to where these laws have been enacted. Let's see how they're applied. Let's unpack the racial inequities in terms of the application. And if we can do that and educate, again, this all comes back to civic participation and voting and transparency and education, because if you don't have the information, we have to have the information, we have to study information, we have to disseminate it in a way that people understand. And when we show that and you have educated voters, they shouldn't be electing people who would be supportive of this. So, but I fear that we don't have a lot of that going on. And what we do have in some areas are real increases in some places related to violent crime, unfortunately, and whether or not they're real, we sometimes have a perception of increases in crime. And so when people are afraid for their personal safety, and when people do not trust law enforcement to keep them safe, that I think we would see an expansion of these laws. And again, this is where I come back to law enforcement. We are absolutely at a crossroads. We've passed the crossroads. I don't know where we are in terms of thinking about reforming policing in the United States. But it is clear, and many studies show, that particularly minoritized populations do not trust the police, do not trust police to keep them safe. So, and that don't trust, you know, interactions between them, because they sometimes end up with deadly consequences. And so we've got to fix that. And we have to let professionals, because I also, while I believe that we need to reform our police agencies, I am not one that would ever say we need to abolish our police agencies. I don't believe that. I think that we need a professionalized group of folks to monitor safety. But again, professionalized, acting as you would in a democratic nation, right? That has a constitution, following rules. So until we live up to that ideal, we very well may have vigilantes on all sides who are taking things into their hands and who are shooting indiscriminately and inappropriately in situations where lives could be saved.
For folks who, you know, after listening to you, or hopefully before listening to you, but now even more so, are concerned about this, particularly, I mean, for me, it's the spread of Stand Your Ground statutes that we've seen during COVID in particular. It seemed like there was a almost explosion of these throughout. What do you have any suggestions for folks for actions that they could take, not just to educate themselves, but to help prevent these in their communities and then nationwide?
Yeah. So I do go back to, I think education is really important. I think that you need to know what these laws, you are, if you're an individual and you live in a certain state, you need to go to the statute, go to the what does it say? and think about how has it been used? And has anybody studied so I'm an academic. So there are things that I would suggest that academics can do. They can have studies and think about these things. But then when you have that information, you've got to get it to the voters, and people have to care. And this is where we go back to the whole, Black Lives Matter movement is, I think we have really underexplored how Stand Your Ground and Black Lives Matter are connected, because what some of these studies are clearly saying is that they don't really, Black lives don't really matter when we're talking about Stand Your Ground. It's if you have a white victim, and we've seen, and that is an analogy that runs throughout the our criminal legal system. So I do think that getting the evidence and the fact we have been for several years, we were in a situation where we were the facts and evidence were not important, but they are. Facts and evidence are important, and we need to get back to evidence-based solutions. And I think if we get the evidence, we cannot justify continuing to enact these laws. So one thing is that we can, and also too, so repeal. I am for repealing that. We should never enact them in the first place. So we should not enact them in the first place. So we should try to contain where we are. And then we should try to repeal. We should think about repealing. There was some momentum at one point in Florida for repealing these laws. But if we can't do that, and those are going to be the two most effective ways, the American Bar Association has actually recommended some safeguards, right? And basically saying that they have to, and this is a quote again from an ABA report, that they should prevent racially disparate impacts and inconsistent outcomes that advantage whites while disadvantaging Blacks. So if we can't stop them from being enacted, if we can't repeal them, can we at least try to minimize the racial disparities that we are seeing?
Well, thank you so much, Cami. This has been so helpful. So Kelly, after talking to you and Cami and all of our other guests, folks are going to make me go to law school and it's going to be bad.
No, you will be an excellent lawyer. But luckily, as Cami articulated, you don't have to be a lawyer to fight femme violence, but you do need to be present in your community and get politically engaged, especially at the local level.
Want to share with the podcast? Listeners can now get in touch with us here at Red, Blue, and Brady via phone or text message. Simply call or text us at 480-744-3452 with your thoughts, questions, concerns, ideas, whatever. Kelly and I are standing by.
Thanks for listening. As always, Brady's life-saving work in Congress, the courts, and communities across the country is made possible thanks to you. For more information on Brady or how to get involved in the fight against gun violence, please like and subscribe to the podcast. Get in touch with us at bradyunited.org or on social at Brady Buzz. Be brave and remember, take action, not type.